So, for this evening's talk, last night I went to do a session with a few of the friends here, the practicing professional psychologists who are also Buddhists. There's a lot of them around these days, these Buddhists who are also psychologists and psychologists who are Buddhists. And we're saying a few things together. And one of the reasons I'm giving this talk this evening was also, not just from last night, just about 10 days ago when I was in Kuala Lumpur giving some talks for the Waisak season. One of these gentlemen came to see me and he said he's from a very, very wealthy family. And he was suffering from depression and anxiety. And so he went over to the United States because he heard this thing called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, started by this doctor in the United States called Jon Kabat-Zinn. He started this movement of using mindfulness to solve his problems. And so he went to, because he was wealthy, had an appointment with him and also checked in the Mayo Clinic. It's a very, very expensive place with all these rich guys, film stars and multimillionaires check in. And he said as soon as he heard what they were teaching over there, all this mindfulness, and he found out that all the doctors there were all practicing Buddhist teachers, he realized, why did I spend all this money traveling all that way? I could have come to the local Buddhist temple and heard it for free. And that's why he came to tell me. And so he said, no, I'm not going there anymore. I'm coming here instead. But this is very true. It's amazing just how many of these teachings which you hear here are state-of-the-art, currently being used by psychologists to treat the problems which are part of modern society. And one of the words which they keep on using is this mindfulness. And basically this all comes from Buddhist teachings. We're the ones who invented mindfulness. It's part of meditation. And sometimes it's not fully understood. As I often said, if you really want the true answers, go to the experts. And these are the people who've been meditating and watching their minds for years. You know, we are the professional meditators. Just because we don't charge doesn't mean we don't know what we're talking about. Because that happened to one of our monks some time ago. This lady called, this American lady, and asked this monk, who said, I hear you're a meditation teacher. He said, yes, I am. And she said, how much do you charge? And he said, nothing, we give it for free. And she replied, well, you can't be any good then, and hung up the phone. So just because we don't charge, it doesn't mean that we don't know what we're talking about. In fact, when people ask that question these days, I say, how much do you charge? I never say for free, because then people don't value what you're teaching. So instead we say that these teachings here on a Friday evening, they're not free. They're priceless. And that gives it a different spin. Prices, you can't put a price on them. That's why you don't have to pay anything. It demeans it. It doesn't mean it's not worth anything. But in particular, those teachings of mindfulness, they're not totally understood. You go to the experts and you see these other parts of things like mindfulness, which when they're understood, give even more power to the effect of these practices in your daily life and also in your spiritual life as well. So today's talk will be on mindfulness, what it is and how it works. Basically, the mindfulness is this awareness which you can focus on all sorts of interesting parts of your life, focusing it on your body as we did at the beginning of this meditation to get to understand your body, get to know it. And a good example of this and how effective it can be is one of the monks, I won't say who he is, but he had a very, very bad back. And he went to see the doctors, they gave him these MRI scans or CAT scans, I don't know what they do, but they gave him the scan and found out there was a genetic deformity in his back. He'd always suffer pain. They couldn't do anything about it. Operations weren't part of it. Maybe painkillers, very heavy painkillers. But he said, especially, don't sit for too long. He said, I'm a monk. I'm a meditator. What are you talking about? That's like telling a tennis player not to use his arms. It's like telling me not to use my mouth. You can't do that. And so that he was in this terrible situation, the doctors couldn't help him, sitting down was going to cause him pain, so he had to find another way. And he used this thing called mindfulness, and this is actually how he did it. He started becoming aware of the feelings in some muscles of his back, which very few people know even exist. To generate that awareness of these muscles on either side of his spine, he would take his hand and just stroke them at first. Stroke them until he could actually feel those muscles. And then afterwards he'd be able to feel those muscles without even touching them. It took many weeks, many months of training. And once he could actually be aware of those muscles on either side of his spine, that awareness gave him some feedback. In other words, he could see how those feelings changed, and that gave him some control. He learned how to stretch and relax those muscles. He literally learned how to exercise them, to stretch them, to pull them, to stretch them and to pull them, to make them stronger, until they became strong enough they compensated for the weakness in his spine. He had no more problems. He could meditate and stay as a monk. That is one example of what this actually mindfulness is and how it can work. It gets you aware of things which most of you are not aware of at all, focusing that awareness. That awareness gives you feedback. You can see how things change in that area of your life or that area of your body, and you can see when it changes for the better or changes for the worse. You know what the causes and conditions are. It gives you some control. Ability to either to strengthen weak parts, to let go of problems, and thereby solve a huge number of difficulties in your life. The awareness is what we're trying to encourage and trying to have grow. Unfortunately, many people are not much aware at all. In the mindfulness teachings, I always say that mindfulness is learning, actually what I learned last night, I might get it wrong, learning how to focus, control, keep bringing your attention onto one thing. And one of the best ways of using that is a bit of curiosity. And when I heard that, I said, that is a little bit too much of control. It won't really work that way, because what will be happening, your mindfulness will get tired. It will become weak. One of the things as a Buddhist meditator, which I know from many, many years of experience, this thing which we call awareness, the ability to be aware, you know, of, say, you know, your feelings in the body, aware of the reactions you have in the mind, just even aware of the temperature in this room. That ability to be aware is not just, you know, either you have it or you haven't. It's not just black and white. It's got all different grades of intensity and power. And now that's the most important thing, which I've never heard coming from psychology, especially in the United States. It's not just being mindful. It's being very mindful. I coined the words power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. Because this is actually what you experience when you train your mind. You actually find that ability to be aware is not just one thing. You can increase its intensity in the same way that you can increase the light in this room and you tend to see more. An example which I often use, which is anyone who is a man understands this, because that you're out here in public and because you have to look decent, you have to shave every day. When you're living in the forest, as a forest monk, shave every 3 or 4 days. It didn't really matter. Just only the jungle animals would see you, and they didn't really mind whether you're unshaven or not. But I remember the first time I went to visit my mother, she really complained, "Shave! You know, you look like some desperado, you know, from the streets, some homeless guy." So I had to learn how to shave every day. And then when you shave every day, it's a pain, not in the pain in the neck, a pain in the front of your face, just under your chin. And not only that, that sometimes, you know, shaving in monastery is not so bad because, you know, it's in a simple place, no real lights, the mirror is just a very, very old one, wearing out. But sometimes when I go traveling and go and give these talks overseas, they put me up in hotels and they've got these mirrors which not only have their own light, but they amplify what you see. And I'm shaving and shaving and shaving, and still you can see the stubble. And that's really a pain. I wish we didn't have those mirrors. So, you know, you can go, I can't see anything, so it's good enough. But they'll use that as a simile for mindfulness. Just ordinary light, you can't see the stubble. You can't see the pimples on your faces for the women. You can't see the little force because the light is dull. But once that light really turns up, you can see everything. Even the faults and the mistakes of your makeup and the grey hairs in your head. You can see so much when the lights get turned up. Now, this is what we mean by power mindfulness. The lights get turned up. You can see much more and you can see in deeper depth. Now, the point is that how can you turn up that mindfulness? How can you make it stronger? And you discover that, hopefully many of you even here discover it, every time you meditate. The mindfulness increases. It's one of the reasons why we meditate before the talk, not after the talk. Because a little bit of meditation actually makes your mind clearer, increases the mindfulness, so you can actually literally understand and pick up more of what's being said. It's an increase in the power of your mindfulness. Now, I noticed this many, many times, especially when I started doing meditation retreats, long periods of meditation. Now, I usually tell these stories only in meditation retreats, not usually here on a Friday evening, which is why that if you've been on retreats, you've heard these stories many times, but most of you here on a Friday night haven't heard these stories about how to create power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness and what it actually feels like. And afterwards, you will be able to understand how it can be very useful for your lives. Even the very first meditation retreat I did when I was still a student at Cambridge, the first meditation retreat we did was in a boarding house. Now, it was in a vacation period. Our group hired 3 boarding houses, and this, one of the friends here was actually from Cambridge, in Bateman Street, Cambridge. I even remember just the name of the place. And we were going to meditate for 9 days. Now, those of you who know boarding houses, this was in 1970, I think, would know that boarding houses haven't got the best food. Now, this was in England, remember? And in England, people in the 70s, they've got much better these days. They weren't noted for having fine cuisine. In fact, usually, you know, we had what was usually called a meat and 2 veg diet. That's all they knew. And it didn't matter what vegetable it was, it all tasted the same. Simply because any flavor had been boiled out of it for hours and hours of boiling. That's why you have to have gravy or salt or something to give it some taste. And as soon as I realized that I was going to do a retreat for 9 days and have boarding house food, that was one reason I thought maybe I should get some sandwiches and take them along. But, to my great surprise, that food was delicious. Weird. At the time, I thought it was just good fortune. You know, maybe we just got one cook in the whole of England who could actually know how to present food. But it wasn't the cook. Later on, I realized because I was meditating, my mindfulness had increased. So whatever little flavor was left after all that boiling and steaming, I could actually pick up. And many people notice that. After meditating, the food tastes more rich. You can feel just your body much more, the heat. You can understand more sound. You become far more sensitive after you've done some meditation. And after many, many years of meditating and examining how this works, what actually empowers that mindfulness and gives it strength is what we call stillness. Letting things be. Not reacting. Just being here. Not planning. Not remembering. Just being and accepting. Being kind. All those things create this quality we call stillness. And I understood this by giving a framework for the human mind. Now, this is one way of looking amongst hundreds of ways of looking at the human mind. It's not definitive. It just serves a purpose of explaining where power mindfulness comes from. Your mind has two parts to it, I often say. The first part is the passive part of your mind. It just knows, it feels, it can see, it can understand. The second part of your mind is the reactive part of the mind. That which thinks, which plans, which reacts, which does. I call it the doer, the doing mind. First part is the passive, the knowing mind. The second part is the doing mind. Now, once you have that framework, you understand what I'm talking about. That part of your mind which is always reacting, planning, talking, struggling, controlling, the active part of the mind, you'll begin to notice that that takes up the lion's share of your energy. You're always thinking, doing, reacting, planning, remembering. Very rarely are you just letting things be without reacting. And it's because that takes up so much of the mental energy of the human being. Only a tiny amount is left for knowing, for being aware, for being mindful. Which is why many people are dull. So dull that sometimes they think that, yeah, they know what's going on, but you don't. That life is just greys and blacks, pastel colours, washed out without any depth or colour. It's just like food which has been boiled to bits so it has no taste. But once one starts doing a bit of meditation, once one starts to let things be without reacting, what actually happens is energy is freed to go into the mindfulness. It's no longer wasted in reacting, into thinking, into planning, into lingering on the past. You can understand the busyness of the mind. When that's stopped, where does that energy go? It goes into knowing, into being aware. Your awareness gets a boost of energy. And because it gets a boost of energy, whatever you see has got richer color. Whatever you smell has got more depth to it. Even whatever you touch, you can actually feel more. And even the taste of food becomes more delicious. Literally, your senses, that which knows, is becoming more powerful. And you have some great stories and interesting events when this starts to happen. Now, I told in one of my books the story of the clump of bamboo. I didn't tell in one of my books what happened on a retreat down in Jhana Grove a couple of years ago, because it's a bit naughty to tell this story, but I told it many times on the retreat, so I don't see why I can't tell it here. And that was one day, after getting into very nice deep meditation, my mind was just so powerful, so I'd let go so much, been so still, my mindfulness was incredibly strong. Walking out of the meditation hall, you know, the flowers were incredibly bright, they're fluorescent, just my mindfulness was so strong. The reason why I left the hall was because I had to go to the toilet. And after I went to the toilet, I just happened to look in the bowl. And my goodness, I never seen such a beautiful piece of shit in my life. You wouldn't believe the different shades of brown. It wasn't just brown. It was rich and powerful. And not just one shade, different types of brown, the way they melded into each other. And the way the little balls were fitted together. I mean, that was artistic. That was aesthetic. And as for the fragrance, oh, that was just like a perfume coming off. And it was amazing. And it was like a diamond because a little bit of slime, a little bit of mucus on the outside made it glisten in the light. Wow, I never seen in my whole life such a beautiful turd. And it was so tough. It was so difficult, but because I'm my monk and my monk's training, I could let it go. It was tough. I had to press the button and watch this amazing, beautiful thing go down the toilet. Now, that was no joke. You know, it sounds funny, but that actually happened. How did that happen? What's going on? You're not going crazy. All that's really happening is you're getting incredibly mindful, really aware. And what you see is so much more detail. Detail which you pass over. You haven't seen that before. It's there. Not only more detail, but you get more joy as well. And things which you think would be disgusting, you can see beauty in them. Now you can understand how you can have a happy life. Things which, you know, you pass away as being ugly, repellent, you can see the beauty in them. Even the ordinary stuff. My goodness, that's incredibly beautiful. There was one time, this was when I was still in Thailand as a monk, we were doing walking meditation. As we're doing walking meditation in this concrete floor in the hall in this northeast of Thailand, this monastery, we're walking, getting more and more still, the mindfulness increasing, getting stronger and stronger, and I had to stop. So I'm looking at this concrete floor, and again, that concrete floor was like a work of art. It wasn't grey, it had these different shades of grey, it had texture to it. It was like a mountainscape. And you saw so much, I actually had to stop and just stare for about 15 minutes, see so much beauty in there. And I thought of actually cutting that out and sending it to, say, the Tate Gallery in London as a work of art. That's what it looked like. Why? Because my mindfulness was so strong, you could see incredible beauty in there. This is one of the things which mindfulness training does not tell you about, how mindfulness gets powerful. Not only do you see much more, but what you see is so richer that it gives you the sense of joy, beauty and happiness. This actually comes together. It's just like sometimes that life is grey and dull. I remember just years ago going to see my brother, and he was telling me about the beginning of discovering this seasonal affective disorder, you know, SAD, sad, where many people in London were getting very depressed, usually around the months of November, December, January. If ever you've been to London at that time of the year, you can understand why they get depressed. It's dark, it's grey, and all the people are all dressed up. I even mentioned this in one of the books. You go to London in that time of the year, you look up in the sky, you don't see a blue sky, you don't see the sun, it's all cloudy and grey. And you know, you've been to London, the buildings, do they paint them nice colours? You know, like in sort of southern Europe. Everything is grey, even the walls, it's grey stone walls. And the ground is grey, and people, they don't wear nice colourful clothes like they do. Even your clothes are a bit sort of dull. And wear something bright and nice, like myself, or like that monk last week from Thailand. Nice bright orange robes, cheers people up. But because over there in England, people just wear grey clothes, grey jackets, grey trousers, grey walls, grey sky, everything is grey. And even, as I joke, the tea they like the best in England is Earl Grey tea. Everything is grey. No wonder they get depressed. And what I heard, the therapy which overcame that depression, was just going into a room with all the lights turned up really, really brightly, forcing them to wear these Hawaiian shirts, multicolours, with really loud music, just to get their senses woken up. And that was the therapy which they used. Because when you get depressed, everything is grey. And the food is all tasteless. And life has just got no oomph behind it. Isn't that, for those of you who've experienced depression, what it's like? Well, that can be seasonal affective disorder, where the place where you live creates that problem. That shouldn't be the case in a place like Perth, which is very bright and vibrant. But nevertheless, it does happen. All it is that even here, you can't see the deep greens and the blues of the sky. You just can't see it. Why? It's because your mind is very tired. It hasn't got enough energy. The mindfulness is very weak. When you understand that the way to overcome that weak mindfulness is actually through a bit of stillness. Not fighting, not controlling, not doing more things. Not fighting the depression or the sadness, but letting it be. Letting it be means whatever energy you have left is going into the knowing mind, the mindfulness, instead of going into the reactive mind. Which means your knowing mind is waking up. You literally come out of the mist, and after a while, your mind becomes bright, happy, alive. You can see more. The colours are richer. The other simile which I give to give you some understanding of this. These are all similes, but this is a talk about mindfulness. I'm bringing in some similes from other areas. It was Bodhinyana Monastery, where we live in Serpentine. Many of you have gone there many, many times, but how many of you have walked that last 2 kilometers from the bottom of the hill, Southwest Highway, up into the monastery? It took me 7 years of living in that place before I, for the very first time, walked up the road where I lived. Been there for 7 years, up and down that road in cars for a long time. One day I decided, beautiful morning, I needed the exercise, told the driver, let me out the bottom, I'm going to walk up. And I did, by myself, just walking up that road, nothing to do, just enjoying the beautiful spring morning, I think it was. I had to stop. I could not recognize my surroundings at all. That hillside looked totally different, absolutely different than what I remembered watching through the window of a car. I saw things I'd never seen before. Little rocks, trees, which I didn't even recognize. And I thought, why is this so strange? I've been up and down this road for such a long time, now I'm seeing it as if for the first time. So what I did, just normally, I just stopped, stood, and just watched. And because I was still, the hillside changed again. The colors grew richer, the detail filled out, and I saw little flowers. You know, this sort of the tessellated bark of the trees, little rocks, the stream down the bottom. I'd missed that before. And it was so incredibly beautiful. I'd never seen that hillside so beautiful ever before. And that was such a shocking experience, I had to figure out why. And from figuring out why, I got this marvelous simile for mindfulness, how it works, and why a lot of people don't really understand who they are, what they're doing, and don't appreciate the beauty and wonder of life. Because what was happening, when you look through the window of a car, the light falling on the back of your eye does not have enough time to form a proper image before another image comes up, dislodges the first, and you have to attend to that, and then another image, then another image. The organ of sight depends upon the chemical reaction on your retina. It's basic science. You probably did that at school. Because that chemical reaction doesn't have time, the colors are not fully formed, nor is the detail made evident. The images go too fast. You miss too much. When you get out of the car and walk, the light falling on the back of your eye has much more time to form an image, which means it has more detail and the colors are richer. But nothing beats standing perfectly still and allowing the image to fully form with all its detail and the proper richness of color. Which is why when I stood perfectly still, the greens and the blues and the yellows, and there's so many different shades of color, it was like they were fluorescent. I saw so much detail, I'd never seen it so beautiful before. Because I was still, you see much more, and it was so much more beautiful. The mindfulness had increased. How many of you accept you live your life like looking through the window of a speeding car, going so fast, you think you understand your surroundings, you think you know the street in which you live. If you've always got up and down that street where you live in the car, in the next week, walk up and down that street, you won't notice where you live, it'll be totally different, you see so much more. It shows that this is actually true. This is just seeing. How about hearing, feeling? We go so fast. We don't feel deeply enough. We don't even hear the rich tones of the human voice or the sound of the wind in the trees. It's because we move too fast. That's why we miss so much. Through stillness, our senses increase in their amplitude and sensitivity. And there's so much going on there. It's impossible to be depressed. In fact, there's so much detail, there's so much texture, so much flavor that actually excites the mind, which means we get joy. rather than the sadness. What's happening is you're empowering your mindfulness. You may actually say as a definition, a working definition, that what depression is a low level of mindfulness. Very weak, like the battery run out of power, it needs recharging. And it's the stillness recharges it. When that mindfulness gets that strong, it's amazing just what you can do with that awareness, with that mindfulness. You can really pay attention. You pick up more. It's one of the reasons why this mindfulness training is very popular in schools and universities, because you people at schools and universities have to do a lot of work. You have to absorb information. And if your mind is tired, how on earth can you absorb that information? You don't see it, you don't hear it, you don't see the essence of it. It's amazing, you can give talks, and some people, because they're very mild, they get it straight away. Others, you have to listen to it many, many times before you get it. Just the tiredness of the mind, it just doesn't see, it doesn't accept, it doesn't appreciate, it doesn't absorb. Which is why that when the mindfulness actually happens, you find you're so alive, so absorbing, that you can just listen to one talk, one lecture, and you understand it, it goes in, you can remember it. I had a natural ability, I had a very good memory at school, which is why I had an easy time at school. You could recall things and recall when they were said. It wasn't a photographic memory, it was a natural mindfulness and awareness, which was very, very strong. And that's why when you teach this to kids at school, the academic performance goes up. This was why in, let's not say Wellington School. Wellington School is a public school in England which started introducing meditation, or rather they called it mindfulness practice, as a regular, a compulsory subject once a week for every kid in a public school in England, simply because it worked. And I remember there was one of the members from here many years ago, I can say it because many years ago, she started introducing meditation to her grade 6 class in Rolleystone Primary School. And I remember going to visit the school many times, and this grade 6 teacher, she was had total support from the principal, and when I went to have a cup of tea with the principal said, look, I'm not a Buddhist, I'm a Christian, but I'll support this girl to the max. Many of my the parents of my children have come to complain, this girl is teaching Buddhism in our school, we're Christians. But he said, look, it's nothing to do with religion. It works. Because what was actually happening? They were training these kids in, they called it quiet time. Just being still and quiet for a few minutes every day. This teacher said she started with 5 minutes in the morning at the beginning of the year, and she built it up to about 15 minutes by the end of the year, 6 year. And she told me these amazing anecdotes. The principal knew that the academic performance was much better than expected. It was actually working. But the teacher was saying some other unexpected results of what was actually increasing the kids' mindfulness. One of the unexpected results for this teacher was how everybody became emotionally much more sensitive. They got to feel just the emotional quality in the room. So much so, she gave one example. There was a bit of a fight, some sort of jealousy, some sort of upset in the classroom. And one of the girls put her hand up, Miss, can we have quiet time now? Diffusing sort of a tense situation which could boil over into some anger or some fight in the classroom. 5 or 10 minutes of quiet time and everything was much more peaceful. They were so sensitive to each other, they became actually more caring. This is what happens when you're more aware of yourself, you're more aware of the others, you get a much more harmonious, sensitive, emotionally mature group of people. Why? Because you're seeing more. You're not just seeing the feelings in the body, you're seeing what's happening in your mind and what's actually occurring. And once you start to get that feedback, which mindfulness gives you, know what's going on very clearly, it becomes very evident to you. if you keep on going on that path of anger, criticism, bitterness towards one another, that just is going to just give you a lot of pain and suffering and give other people a lot of pain and suffering. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever once you're aware of what you're doing and its results. So once that awareness is there, you become very, very cognizant of the problems in your life, the problems in your body, the problems in your life. I like to say the problems in the body, first of all, because people are much more aware of their body than they are of their emotional world. And I already mentioned one case of that young monk who basically cured the problem by being aware of muscles and strengthening them. Now, many other monks can be aware of their body and heal their own pains and diseases. Maybe I won't speak of other monks, I'll speak of that story I've told a few people recently. About 2 years ago, just about 18 months ago probably now, during our retreat period at our monastery, myself and many other monks got food poisoning. It's what we call occupational hazard, because we don't choose our food. Whatever you take to the monastery, that's what we have to eat. And sometimes people, they want to sort of try out a new dish. So you try out on the monks or the nuns, first of all, free guinea pigs, and see if we like it. So the occupational hazard, being like a mendicant monk, you know, we don't actually choose our food. We don't cook it. You bring it. We don't know what's in it. So, you know, sometimes, you know, make the wrong choice. And that was a really bad choice. Myself and a couple of other monks got this terrible food poisoning. So what I was doing, I was rolling, literally rolling on my in my cave where I live, at monastery in Serpentine, rolling around. I couldn't sit still because, you know, your guts were cramping up. And those of you who have had food poisoning, you know how painful it is. Should have really gone to the doctor, but instead of going to the doctor, after enduring for a little while, I said, what would I tell other people to do? You know what it's like when you're a teacher? Sometimes you tell other people what to do, but you don't do it yourself. So I said, what would I tell other people? Oh, this is what I would tell other people to do. Be mindful and be kind. That's all. And this is what I did. And it was, I said this experience because it really is amazing what you can do. I was aware of those physical feelings in the body, which was very, very tough to do, because when you have pain, you want to run away or you want to control it. I had to let it be, to be still. Not trying to get rid of it, not trying to control it, not doing anything with it. So the mindfulness could get really strong, so I could fully feel those negative, painful feelings. As soon as I was receiving those feelings, I noticed they were changing because I was giving it some kindness. You notice the feeling got less. I was putting full awareness onto it, seeing how those feelings changed. When it got less, that was because I was being kind. So I carried on that same movement of the mind, that same intention of kindness. It relaxed even more. Keep on the same direction. I was getting feedback every second from my mindfulness. It took 20 minutes, that's all. And that feeling of pain totally disappeared. I don't show how about the physical part of it, how the sort of the bacteria sort of stopped, you know, causing you sort of the cramps, but totally relieved of all the symptoms, all the pain, got up, no more food poisoning. 20 minutes it took. Because I knew it wasn't just mindfulness, the mindfulness showed how these things can change. It gave you that necessary feedback, so you had, in a sense, control, knowing a way out. That mindfulness gives you that feedback. Which is why if you want to learn how to relax the body, relax the mind, or even relax, you know, parts of your internal organs, you can do that with mindfulness. And the most impressive part of that was to see what really relaxed it. And that was compassion and kindness. You know, it's very difficult to talk about compassion, kindness. Everybody assumes they know what compassion is. They know what kindness is. Yeah, we know what compassion is. Yeah, but you don't. That's the problem. Here, what compassion is, what kindness is that attitude of mind which relaxes the problems, which allows things to go, which stops fighting. That's why I love calling it opening the door of your heart unconditionally, which means not controlling anymore, letting things be, accepting them, embracing them, valuing them. That's what compassion is. So when you add that compassion to the mindfulness, it's amazing to see how things move into a more positive direction. Pains get relieved. Even big pains. And I have taught that even to people with cancers, especially breast cancers. Feel that pain there. Feel that lump. Feel whatever is going on in your body. Not with any negativity, not trying to control it, not trying to get rid of it, but being kind to it. And you can feel with your mindfulness the whole thing start to go move into a more positive situation until the thing disappears. And that's with the body. But in life we use that with the mind as well, with the mental world. When I was teaching meditation to begin with, relax the body, relax the mind, that's what we're talking about. And to be able to do that, the mindfulness, the awareness, you can see what's going on, and the compassion starts to relax things. They start to disappear. The classic story, again, another classic story to deal with this, to explain it, was a story, again, I told this last night, a few of you here from last night, but this is a powerful story. One of the disciples, well, wasn't a disciple at that time, certainly is a disciple now. She was that student, that young girl in Adelaide University studying dentistry who got into severe anxiety disorder, so bad that she was bedridden. She had a young man who was looking after her, a boyfriend, cooking for her, cleaning, while she was totally incapacitated in bed. The local doctor at the university couldn't help, the local psychologist couldn't help. Fortunately, her uncle, a Thai man, is a regular supporter of this monastery, so at the last resort, go and call the monks. So she called me. And this is how I taught her meditation, mindfulness, together with compassion, and the brilliant result it had on her. And I like sharing this story because it shows that you can do this, and it is highly effective, incredibly powerful. So I asked her straight away when she called me, and when she told me what was wrong, I said, well, you know, when you have these anxiety feelings, these panic attacks, where do you feel them in your body? And she said, I don't know. So I said, okay, give me a call back when you can find out. I was giving her something to do. As I was told last night, giving her some control over her treatment. I wasn't just telling her what to do, she had to participate. Where do you feel that? The first little training in mindfulness of the feelings in her body. After 3 or 4 days, she said she felt them in her chest, just above her breast, below her neck. She felt them in this area. So I asked her, what do they feel like? Describe those feelings to me. She said, I can't. So ring me up in a few days when you can tell me. Giving her a task to do, and also making sure that she was becoming much more aware of those feelings, because she had to explain them to me in a few days' time. So she had to really investigate. It gave her motivation to become more aware of those feelings. And after the next 3 days, she said, and she made this wonderful description of these feelings in her chest. And then I said, right, now I want you to put your hand on that chest whenever you have an anxiety attack. Start to massage it with as much compassion as you possibly can and see what happens to those physical feelings. If you can't do that, get your boyfriend to do it. And give me a call in a few days' time. She gave me a call in a few days' time and said, yes, I did what you were told. I said, how did that physical feeling, what happened when you massaged it? She said, actually, my mindfulness was strong enough I could actually see it. It relaxed. It got less and less. The physical component just started to alleviate. Got less and less and less. And then I asked her the question, what happened to the anxiety in your mind? And that was when she had this wonderful pause. There's wonderful moments in life when you're teaching somebody and they get it. Now those light bulb moments in life. She paused and she said, the anxiety went. Brilliant, now you know what to do. And she practiced that method. Instead of attacking the anxiety on the mental level, which she had no real mindfulness and control over, the physical level, she relaxed the part of the body which always got tense when anxiety came up, just through massage. So the next time she got anxiety, she massaged that area, next time, and the anxiety got less and less and less, till she was out of bed. Really clever girl, went to finish her studies, she got a first in dentistry. She's now doing this special course over in Sydney. She's probably listening this evening. You know, all the best to you, because she married that boy who looked after her, and I did the ceremony for her in the Sunken Gardens in UWA. A very wonderful, got a beautiful life now. And she has this control over her emotions. She knows every emotion, whether it's anger, whether it's grief, always has a physical component to it. Find out what that physical component is. You're becoming aware, mindful. And then you can relax that part, and with it the rest of the body, the rest of the emotion disappears. If you can't do that with your body, at least you're becoming more aware of these things in the mind. You know what makes them worse, you know what makes them sort of alleviate, get less of a problem. And you'll find that fighting, control, basically wanting, is what causes that emotional world to lock up and become stressful and tight. This thing called compassion, kindness, that is what loosens things, even in the mind. So if ever you are angry, if you're grief-stricken, if you're in a panic, when you're aware of the feeling, add this beautiful thing called kindness, let it be compassionate, and if you have enough awareness, you will notice those feelings which are causing the problem get less. Now you know how to overcome these things. More kindness, more compassion, together with mindfulness, and they get less and less and less, and they disappear. It is this beautiful combination of mindfulness with compassion. And you understand what compassion is, you understand what mindfulness is, you become a very, very powerful being who can deal with some of the difficulties in life yourself in a very, very effective way. Spiritually, you're learning about your emotional world. You're getting to understand it. This is your investigation. This is what you're aware of. You're turning up the lights in your own mind, in your emotional world. Not only turning them up, but you're learning how to deal with them. You're learning what real compassion, kindness truly mean. And you're understanding its power. No longer is this just a theory you learn from listening to monks like me. It's not just a belief from a book. This is actually something you experience, put into practice, and it's incredibly powerful. And you realize it for yourself. The problems which cause you upset can disappear. Even marriage problems. Why is it that people, when they've been married for such a long time, start to say really rotten things to each other? You know, just the language which, you know, which husbands and wives use after 3 or 4 years. The old joke is, in the first year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. The second year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the third year of marriage, the neighbors listen to both of them. They argue so loud. Why do you do that? Now, that's a real problem, a very hard problem, which many of you have experienced. Why? So, number one, mindful. Be aware of what's going on in your mind when that happens. And then add this wonderful thing called compassion and kindness. It softens this mental world of yours. And when you become so soft that your partner can say anything to you, just smile. In other words, you don't react anymore. That reaction which we have shows we've got a very brittle mind, very hard. How can we soften it? No, your wife says that just because she's upset. It's nothing to do with you when she starts being grumpy at you. It's just it's telling you how she feels. Anyone who gets angry, who scolds you, who says rotten things to you, it says more about them than it says about you. You've heard that one before, and that's really, really true. Anyone who criticizes you, gets angry at you, it shows that they have the problem, not you. That's why you think, what have I done? I've done nothing. Why are you getting so angry at me? Indeed, you haven't done anything. It's just they're in a bad mood. The reason they're in a bad mood is because they're so tight inside. They haven't had that mindfulness and that kindness to relax and to soften their mind. Of course, there's huge amounts of problems. So just that little bit of mindfulness and compassion, learning what these things are, saves so many problems in life. Health problems, emotional problems, relationship problems. That's why mindfulness, once you understand what it is, should always be hand in hand with kindness. and to understand what kindness is, compassion is, use that mindfulness and see what relaxes, what eases, what softens, what lessens the problems. That is what compassion is. You feel it, you know it, you get to understand it. And this thing called compassion, which you thought you knew all about, suddenly opens up to you. You really understand its depth, its beauty, and its power. It's something which you know and you can put into practice at any time with your mindfulness and creates an enormous amount of power and well-being in your life and in others. Problems of your life tend to disappear. Have much more fun, much more energy as well, and much more happiness. I work so hard. I sometimes tire myself out, but I know how to get this mindfulness and compassion going and really start to not fire on all four cylinders, fire on 40 cylinders. That's what it feels like sometimes. So this is how it works. This is my secret, and I share it with you today. What mindfulness is, together with compassion. And it's not just, they call it MBCT in psychology, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. I've changed that, mindfulness-based compassionate therapy. Put that together, and then we're getting somewhere. And you heard it here first. So, thank you for listening to this talk on mindfulness. Now we do have some... Yeah, go on, if you want to do it. Yeah, thank you. Doesn't it feel good when you just express yourself? Why do some people clap and then stop? Well, you're mindful of nothing. Oh, what's people going to say about me? Is it the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? Just do it, for goodness sake. Ah, now this is... got questions here. The first one from Costa Rica. These talks go all over the world. From Costa Rica, this is a doozy of a question, a really good one. My girlfriend has recently dumped me. How can I practice mindfulness to suffer less? you know what it's like when you're young and you get dumped. How mindfulness? Okay, you get mindful of those feelings of sadness, maybe guilt, maybe inadequacy. A lot of times when pain happens, we tend to blame. Usually blame ourselves. Oh, you know, I should have done better. I wasn't so kind. Maybe I should have brushed my teeth more. Maybe I should have done whatever it is. So first of all, be mindful of what's going on in your head. And be kind to those feelings. You know, it's okay to feel sad. What kindness is opening the door of your heart to the feelings in your head and to the feelings in your body. Not fighting them. Because you're not fighting them, you're opening the door of your heart to feeling that way, you find the mindfulness increases, you can see more, you can see exactly what's going on, and the compassion also not just increases the mindfulness, but lessens the harshness of the symptoms. You get so soft. Oh, girlfriend dumps me. Yeah, fine, we had a wonderful time together, a great time, marvelous, goodbye, let's get girlfriend number two, or three, or four, five, or six, or seven. Whichever one you're on. So again, fighting the symptoms is what causes them to be worse. Being kind to them means being wise to them, being mindful of them. You can understand them. It's very easy to let them go. Middell from Scotland. Can the practice of mindfulness be dangerous in the absence of correct moral standards as set out in the Dharma teachings? Mindfulness can be dangerous if it's not associated with compassion. It's a kindness. When that's lost, then it can be dangerous. The usual story, I say, it's a bit of a cheeky story, that once there was a very wealthy lady, and she was coming to the temple to listen to a talk, and because she was afraid of thieves sneaking into her mansion, she told her guard, and had a security guard at the gate, said, "I'm going to the temple tonight. Please be very mindful of thieves. I want to be very mindful of thieves because they're dangerous." So she goes to the temple. When she comes home, she finds the thieves have been in her house and stolen everything. "I told you to be mindful," said the owner. I said, "Madam, I was mindful. I saw the burglars going in and I noted burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them taking all your jewelry out. I was very mindful. I noted, jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I saw them go in again. I was mindful, burglar going in again, burglar going in again. I saw them taking your safe out, safe going out, safe. I was very aware, very mindful, madam. Now that's what we call dangerous mindfulness. Stupid mindfulness. It's just being aware with nothing else. It's not just being aware. It's being compassionate. You've got to be compassionate, you know, to yourself. You know, so you, compassion to yourself means you don't go and fight those burglars. You might get killed. It's being compassionate to the owner of the house, compassionate to your family who's going to suffer when you lose your job. It's this beautiful compassion which shows you the right thing to do. The kind thing to do, which is, you know, usually calling the police. It's their job. Give them some work to do. So remember, mindfulness just by itself can be, not dangerous, but can get you into trouble. Or like the other story, I can't resist telling this story. I told it last night. I think it's, you know, there are actually real Buddhist meditation jokes these days. Because Buddhism is becoming a part of, like, Australian culture. We get real jokes. And that was the guy who went to the meditation retreat. And the following day after the retreat, went to work in Perth Zoo. And he was so calm and so peaceful. Even when he was walking very slowly as he came to work. And so the head keeper said, well, what can I do with this guy until he sort of, you know, comes back to normal? So he got the brilliant idea. He said, this morning, you can look after the tortoises. That's the appropriate thing to do to someone who's just been so peaceful after a meditation retreat. So he said, yes, I will look after the tortoises. So off he went to look after the tortoises. And at lunchtime, the head keeper decided to check up on him. And he saw the door of the tortoise enclosure was open and all the tortoises had escaped. And he said, what happened? And his keeper said very mindfully and slowly, well, I opened the door and whoosh. That's what happens when you're going very slowly. Even tortoises go fast by comparison. That's a really good Buddhist joke. Anyway, so moral standards, this is actually from Scotland. What moral standards are virtue? And this was mentioned, Ajahn Bhamani had mentioned this. That gives you the goodness from which joy and energy comes from. It's the joy which can power the mindfulness. It's not just the curiosity, the joy, the fun in being awake. And a lot of time, if you have lots of virtue, lots of goodness, we have lots of happiness. A mind which is so pure is very bright. Why do we say a bright mind? Because the mindfulness is bright. It is like a bright light inside. This is one of the advantages of virtue. Of being goodness, being kind, keeping precepts, not saying bad things about one another, not sort of being cruel to other people. Your mind becomes very happy. And when it becomes so happy like that, then mindfulness is naturally very strong. So a lot of times people have done bad things they feel very guilty about. And what do? They usually go into alcohol and drugs to try and escape, to dull their mind out. They don't want to be aware. They're afraid what they're aware of. So a lot of times there is a way out of that. If you feel guilty, to learn how to let go of guilt. That's in many other talks which we have given here, how to not carry it around with you. But if you're virtuous, you get a lot of happiness, a lot of joy, naturally. And that empowers mindfulness. So the virtuous have a natural power of mindfulness. Anyway, Andrew from Christchurch, dear Ajahn, what happens to the mind when we are sleeping? It has a rest, it sleeps. Are we in mindfulness during the sleep? No, you're not mindful when you're asleep. Not even the Buddha was mindful when he was asleep. His mind had turned off. Now, the reason why there's a problem here is because there is one of the suttas, the Satipatthana Sutta, it says, you're mindful while awake and while asleep, and that is a long translation. What it really means, it's the not the mindfulness, but the sampajanya, which is like the understanding. You understand why you go to sleep, the meaning of it, just to rest the body, not just to escape and indulge. A lot of times people go to sleep a lot because they don't like being alive. This was actually, I heard this in, when I went to speak in prisons. They had a saying in prison here in Western Australia, one extra hour of sleep is 1 hour off your sentence. You can understand the logic of that. Being in prison was very, very unpleasant. So 1 hour of sleep, you weren't in prison when you were asleep. So that's why the prisoners try to sleep as much as they possibly could. So you're not awake when you're asleep. The mind, and if you do try and do that, sometimes it happens. Your mindfulness does get very strong on retreats. So strong you can't go to sleep. Now you're laying down there perfectly awake all night. Rested, no problem at all. It's not like the normal cases of insomnia where the brain really gets worn out and gets into a very, very unpleasant state. If you are still, and you know, so much energy you don't want to sleep at night, it's perfectly fine, you're just having a good time. And it's true, you don't need to sleep. That's why I often notice when you work hard, you need to sleep more. When you get on your meditation retreats and it starts buzzing, you hardly need to sleep at all. An hour or two, get up, you're fully awake. You don't need sleep because the mind is not, the brain is not working so much. So it doesn't need to rest. When you don't use your car, it doesn't need so much gas. Does mindfulness have anything to do with our good dreams and bad dreams? Thank you. Not so much your mindfulness, but just the quality of the mindfulness. Basically, just your kindness, your goodness. If you've done something bad today, sometimes it comes out in your dreams. If you've done a beautiful act, wonderful, so kind, so generous, so loving, then that comes out in your dreams. You have a beautiful dream. So the best way to have beautiful dreams is to have a beautiful day. If you have a beautiful day, you have beautiful dreams. If you have a troubled day, troubled dreams. So you can make your day beautiful. It's not what happens to you, it's how you react to what happens to you. Doesn't matter what it is. If you act and say, oh, this is difficult today, that's part of life. Yeah, fine. Just more dung for my mango tree, as I keep saying. There's no problem anymore. It's not life, it's our relationship to life is a problem. And that comes out in our dreams. So, there we have some questions and answers on mindfulness. Is there any questions from the locals? From those right in front of me now on mindfulness? Anyone want to ask a question? Especially the supports with compassion. Put them two together. Going. Sorry? No, not yet. You must be patient, because part of mindfulness is learning how to be in mindful in the moment, to wait in the moment, not wait in the future, to be very, very patient. Any questions? No? Go. So thank you all for listening. And hope you enjoyed tonight's talk. And most importantly, it's not just for entertaining you with stories like the guy who was in charge of the tortoise enclosure. It's also to give you some tools which will improve your life and make you happier, more peaceful people. So you can understand what mindfulness is and what compassion is. Thank you so much for listening. Very good. Very good. Thank you so much. I deserve that. And I'll tell you why the next time I give a talk. Okay, now we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, and then we can go and do whatever we need to do.